Welcome back, everybody, to the Brexit podcast. And welcome back to our founder and co-host, Warren Pohl. Warren, great to have you on the show.
Hello, Tim. It is beautiful to be back.
It's been such a long time. Now, Jen has disappeared, but Jen went to Thailand a few weeks ago, and she's so thrilled with the place. She's now taken her mum away. So we've got you back in to do our weekly Brexit roundup, which excites me greatly. What have you been up to, buddy?
I have been working my socks off. Let's keep it family friendly. I've been working my socks off with the whole business of my sports nutrition company, 33 Shake, which along with my wife and co-founder, Erica, we are growing hugely. But I think we've mentioned this on a podcast before. You know, Brexit has given us more than our share of challenges. You know, it's impacted profit margins, ingredient costs, transport costs, and there is only going to be more of that. But we've chosen to see that as a brilliant stress test for the business. And I'm really happy to report that even though it's caused us a ton of extra work, we're coming out of it very strongly and much stronger for it. So I would never have chosen it, but I'm very glad it's happened. So working on our second product has just launched in America, and we'll be heading back out there to promote that soon, which is kind of what I'm planning right now. But it's very nice to take a break and do something fun like this.
Well, I mean, it sounds like Brexit is always quite high on your agenda, and no doubt you keep abreast of all Brexit matters through the Brexit podcast on a weekly basis.
Tim, I don't miss a single episode or a single opportunity to catch up with you and or Jen, although it's a little harder to catch up with Jen right now, given that she is, of course, in Thailand.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to embarrass you to ask you to name your to stress test that statement and ask you to name your favourite guests. So we'll move swiftly on. I did want to say before we get into our regular weekly news roundup, where we look at five key Brexit points from the week, that we've had some terrific feedback actually on the show recently, and it's been incredibly heartwarming. Aside from Esquire magazine call us weirdly soothing. I've liked the way that people have been quite complimentary. All our guests, whatever side of the debate they've been on, have been terrific people to talk to. And given the whole rhetoric around Brexit's been so divisive, it's actually been quite a privilege to be able to host this show for the past 70 episodes.
I'm not surprised. I mean, I love watching it grow and develop and take shape and, you know, evolve, because the idea when we first talked about this was to provide, it was to be a non-partisan place to, you know, making sense of the nonsense. There's so much tit for tat and back and forth going on in the mainstream media. The aim to provide a place where we can just, you know, let's document and discuss what's happening and what is living through Brexit going to be like. But it's what I could never have envisaged the shape that it's taking and the way that's going. It was just an idea, and that's where we begun, and what you and Jen have done in pulling that forwards and making it a reality, and what the guests have done in influencing it and developing it, it's just been brilliant.
Yeah, one thing that struck me this week, I was speaking to a guest ahead of an interview that we're planning in a couple of weeks' time, and they were saying that a lot of the time when they get interviewed, they will speak for half an hour, but everything's then just paired back to a three-line soundbite. And I know working as a journalist, and we discussed this briefly before we came on, that's often the way of the world. Everything's shorter, snappier, faster. But that's one of the reasons I really love podcasts. It does give an opportunity for a bit more long format. And if people want to deep dive into a particular subject, then it's there for them.
I think you're absolutely right. That is the beauty of the platform. And it's not that the journalism that you and I come from, in my case came from, and it's been a couple of years since I've been active, but it was my career entirely until 33 Shape began, and obviously it's still full-time for you. That model is not broken, it's changing, but what's missing in that model, and we said this earlier, how many times have you or I, as working journalists, you spend an hour interviewing someone and you need that background and you need that feel, but ultimately what you're writing is a 500-word piece, particularly if you're writing for a national paper. So much has to end up on the cutting room floor, and willingly or unwillingly, as the writer, you invariably become judge, jury and executioner as to what goes in and, you know, what's your decision of what the story is. And part of that is a journalist's skill, but part of that is something that can be hugely abused. And it can also leave the people who are so giving of their time and opinions and thought, which you've, you know, you've asked for and generally got for nothing, it can leave them putting in a lot of time for no return. And that's where podcasts just stand head and shoulders above any other media art form out there. I think it really lets people talk. And, you know, the downside of that is you can have some really, really boring podcasts out there, but there's always the skip button, you know. The positive side is people with great things to say or interesting things to say actually have space to put their whole story across.
Okay. Well, let's be judge, jury and executioner now on our top five Brexit points from the last week. And there's nowhere else we can really start for number one, which is the general election on June the 8th. And what I thought we could start with was a quick explainer. You know, where what is the Brexit position of each of the political parties? Now, I think many people may know the position of the main parties, but what about some of the smaller ones? So I just want to run you through this. And this first piece was taken from the BBC, actually, who do quite a nice review of it. We'll drop the link in the show notes if anyone wants to have a look at the full piece. But I'm going to run you through this, Warren, and obviously just challenge up at any time. Thought it was good to do because Theresa May was a soft Remainer initially, and now she's obviously a big Leaver. Corbyn's sort of had quite a bit of anti-EU sentiment over the years, but then Labour at large was Remain. So where quite are we? I think people who are looking now to vote could probably do with a rundown. So let's start with the Tories. So May was obviously against Brexit, as I've just said, before the EU referendum. But as we know, Warren, Brexit means Brexit. And in fact, the reason she gave for calling the general election was to strengthen association with the EU, thinking that would give her more of a mandate. So she plans to withdraw the UK from the single market and strike a new free trade deal. So more Tory MPs backed Remain than Leave, but they now strongly support the UK leaving, so falling in line behind our Prime Minister. Underline that only one voted against the government beginning Brexit by invoking Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. Only one voted against that. So very strongly Leave now, May's message, strong and solid leadership and very much Leave. On to Labour, I suppose still the chief opposition in some ways. They campaigned against Brexit, but they now say that the result must be honoured. Provided the key points for them, there are a few things, but the key points that are workers' rights and access to the benefits of the single market. They're not calling for a second referendum on the final deal, but they do want MPs to have a decisive say on what happens when negotiations are complete. If they were, by some miraculous opinion poll defying voting patterns, elected into government, they would on day one guarantee the rights of EU nationals living and working in the UK to stay in this country. That's Labour for us. I think that is a subject we've talked about a bit. The SNP. SNP leader Nicola Sturgeon has been pushing for Scotland, which voted to remain in the EU, to have special status after Brexit, including remaining in the single market. And she's called for a second independence referendum before the Brexit package has been finalised. Not quite sure whether she's going to get that one. The Lib Dems, they're strongly pro-EU, back to the single market and the free movement of people. And they basically want another referendum. The Green Party, who's the Green Party of England and Wales, and their joint leader, Caroline Lucas, she's also called for a second EU referendum on Brexit, on the Brexit deal, reached with Brussels. UKIP completely the other way from the Green Party and the Liberals, as we well know. Paul Nuttall has vowed to hold the government's feet to the fire on Brexit, and they'll be hoping to take votes from the Labour's in area that backed Leave. Some people think that UKIP's job is now done. We will see how they perform. On to some of the smaller guys. Plaid Cymru, obviously in Wales, campaigned to stay in the EU, but it says that it accepts the people of Wales voted to leave. And again, it's pretty keen on the single market membership to protect the Welsh jobs. And then over in Northern Ireland, the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, they campaigned in favour of leaving the EU. And in its manifesto for this year's Assembly election, said it wanted to see a positive relationship with the rest of Europe, involving mutual access to our markets to pursue common interests. The SDLP, they campaigned to stay in the EU. The MPs have opposed invoking Article 50, saying it's been done against the will of the people of Northern Ireland, where most people voted to remain. Ulster Unionist Party said that on balance, it was better for Northern Ireland to stay in the EU, although not all its members agreed. And Sinn Féin has accused the Tory government of seeking to impose Brexit on Ireland, and it wanted Northern Ireland to have a designated special status inside the EU. So, Warren, I'm not sure if that clarifies matters anymore for anyone. Your thoughts?
I think that's a pretty smart roundup there, Tim. I think it's something we talked about previously is starting to come through. But to sum up your sum up, effectively, you've got the Conservatives hard on the way out. You've got Labour kind of neither in nor out, sort of a bit of both, trying to cover all the bases. You've got the Lib Dems picking up the now challenger baton of really fighting the Remain side, and everyone else then fighting on the basis of national interest for Scotland, for Wales, or for Ireland. So I think you hit that on the head. But the thing we'd mentioned before, and when the election was announced, and I'm not sure whether this was on a podcast or just when we caught up, but we're talking about the idea, why is nobody exploiting the fact that you had 48% of the population who voted to remain? That's a larger chunk than has ever been needed to win an election historically. Who's shooting for them? And interesting to see that, albeit in a slightly cautious way, that the Lib Dems came out on that side, because what was, in marketing, you'd call it a challenger strategy, i.e. if you're launching a new type of Coca-Cola, you can't market your drink the way Coca-Cola do because they dominate. You need to find some way of sort of undermining the big player. Brexit was the challenger strategy. UKIP were spearheading that challenger angle. But now that challenger angle it's the mainstream. It's the status quo. So anyone wishing to take a bite out of the voting pie needs to come up with some sort of challenge. And it seems that there are several on the table. But slightly disappointingly, Labour don't seem to be putting together a cohesive challenge on anything. I guess they possibly have too many bases to cover.
Let's move to point two. I think it was more of an image-led story that led me to this. And it's a very much a Theresa May versus Angela Merkel. And I thought they looked quite well-matched adversaries. And I'm trying not to get all Daily Mail about it, who had the infamous Lexit headline that prompted a tweet from Ed Miliband, the 1950s wants its headlines back, which I thought Ed Miliband's actually a pretty funny guy now since he's stepped out of sort of leading the opposition. I think people perhaps said he was a pretty funny guy when he was trying to be Labour chief, but still that's probably a little bit wider the mark for this. The thing really is that Merkel... it's not going to, when we have touched on this before, but Merkel's not going to give Britain an easy ride here. I mean, she's got bigger fish to fry. I did an interview with Katinka Barić on this, and Katinka was very much saying that for Germany, it's very much a political game at the moment, not an economic one. Merkel's got this re-election battle, so she can't really be seen to be giving too many concessions to Britain. And if we accept that she's the dominant force in the European Union, I mean, she's got, you know, other bailouts to worry about, immigration to worry about, and there's challenges for right-wing conservatism. She needs to kind of cover her bases somewhat. Still adamant there's no revenge for Brexit, but there will be a price to pay. And I kind of feel she, and I think not just me, a lot of people now feel she does hold the key, but we're going to be stuck in a holding pattern in some ways until September the 24th, which is the date of the German election.
I think that's a very clear analysis of that, because from a home point of view, i.e. you're in the UK, you're aware of the UK media, you're watching the UK picture, nothing is more dominant for us right now than the forthcoming election and the subsequent effects and whatever happens with Brexit. So that will dominate our headlines. It's very easy to remember that you don't have to go very far and the picture's going to become very different. Like I'm currently working in Spain and I haven't noticed much of that, unless you nip down to the Costa del Sol, of course, and pick up a copy of the Express. Not something I'm going to be doing in too much of a hurry. So over in Germany, exactly right, Angela Merkel is a key part of any Brexit evolution and whatever's going to be going on for Britain and the rest of Europe. And she has other things she needs to be doing first. But her against May, it's a tricky one because you're right, they look like great adversaries. But how do you start to discuss that or look at that without commenting on the fact that both of them are female? And that very quickly, if we're not careful, does head into the Daily Mail territory, and that's not somewhere we want to go. But you have two strong women taking strong positions, and they both have, you know, elections coming up and things to do, but they're both going to play a key part in what happens next for Europe.
Indeed. Let's move on to point three.
We're on to the fish now.
We are, yes. So long, and thanks for all the fish, or not a fisherman's friend, which I've cunningly called this one. You remember Fisherman's Friend? Did you ever have them? Did your granddad ever give you a Fisherman's Friend?
There is nothing better than sucking on a Fisherman's Friend when you have a sore throat. Everyone knows that, right?
I think that is pretty much the cure for all the world's ills. We have actually got Alan Hastings. Who is from Alan Hastings, the spokesperson for Fishing for Leave campaign. I'm actually speaking to him for an interview in a couple of weeks' time on this very subject. But the Tories have been criticised. They've been criticised for not saying very much, actually, in the manifesto. And it's been based on a sense that it's been based on everyone else being entirely unelectable. So as long as they say nothing, then it's... then they will be fine. The manifesto itself was short in detail, but there wasn't much sent about British waters, and British waters are becoming more of a discussion topic. The fears in this piece that I picked up on were that Theresa May could waive the rights to 95% of British waters post-Brexit, and the Vote Leave campaign says that 200 miles from our coastline, which is what it believes constitute British waters, could be reduced to as little as 12. That's as per the 1964 London Fisheries Convention, because the 200 mile zone, which was agreed under a United Nations convention in 1982, it never needed to be implemented because Britain were already in the European Union. Does that make some kind of sense?
Tim, that makes a lot of sense. And having had a look round this one as well, despite being basically vegan, the vegetarian stroke vegan, I'm still keen on all matters fish related. And nothing stops me reading up on fishing rights because they are fascinating. But you're right that here, British territorial waters, and I believe this applies to most sovereign states, can generally expect a sort of 200-mile zone around your country where pretty much you've got first dibs on the fish, the gas, and all that other stuff, subject to any further deals you may wish to make or any other people may want to come and try and impose on you. And what this piece is saying is that actually, without the Tories being clear, this could be sacrificed, could be dropped to as low as 12. So pretty much you could swim out and catch the fish and that would be about as far as you could go. So let's not get into the environmental angle and overfishing and all that sort of thing. The little alarm that goes off for me with any of these stories is that there is a Brexit angle for every industry in Britain at the moment, and every industry has its vested interest. And in this case, the fishing industry clearly wants their 200-mile zone protected, particularly because, probably in a related story, was the fact that EU fishing boats are already collecting, I think, 58% of the fish in that water anyway. So the fishing industry feels a threat, and out comes this story. And then here's the fact... Theresa May could do nothing because she hasn't said anything about British waters, so she could be waiving the right to 95%. Well, I think that's a figure they have. It's a bit like the 350 million for the NHS, and unfortunately, I don't feel that a number of our leading politicians on any side are doing a great job of like teaching anyone that perhaps you should use facts to make your arguments, not just made up stuff. And I think that this one's a bit like that. You know, of course, Theresa May could be knocking it down to 95, but as she said nothing, they're kind of putting words in her mouth a bit here. Basic thing we could possibly take is that there may be a threat to British sovereign waters. This is another part of the deal that has to be sorted out, and I think the fishing industry wants that on the table, not just on a Friday when we should be having fish, but they want it on the table every day. What do you reckon?
Well, just to hit back at that slightly, Alan Hastings, who I mentioned earlier, who we will have on, and he can explain the position of fishing for leave fully. He feels that the manifesto wording is particularly dubious because he feels there's an implicit message there. So the only way the Tories can, his quote was, the only way the Tories can redeem their position publicly to avoid accusations of a sellout is to affirm categorically that the UK will take back control of our entire, to exercise sovereign control over all the waters and resources within for the benefit of the UK fishermen. He thinks they were quite clever with the wording in the manifesto and suitably vague, and that's what sets off the warning signs for him.
Well, and that's exactly why that man, Alan Hastings, should be on our podcast, because if you boil him down to a soundbite, which is what they've had to do to get their message out there, well, let's go and dig. Let's find out what's behind that soundbite. It's not about finding out who's right and who's wrong, but let's see what the depth of the arguments are, because that would be an interesting one.
Let's move it on. Point four, and I took this from The Guardian, and this is from The Guardian Observer food critic Jay Rayner, and his fears that the food industry is going to be starved of labour after Brexit. So he's done quite a long form piece. We can put links to this in the show notes. And I'm just going to read an extract from this.
Can I just compliment you on the use of the word starved in there? Great, you know, food critic, thanks. Starved. You probably didn't even notice you were doing it, but that's good.
I think it's always, you know, the deliberate use of different words and terminology in introductions is something that I like to think is tripped off seamlessly, but there are hours and hours of work that go into this preparation, Warren, as you well know.
Days, my friend.
So, listen, Jay Rayner writes, last month, as Parliament wrapped up for the general election, the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Selects Committee published a short paper called Feeding the Nation, Labour Constraints. Around 20% of all employees in British agriculture come from abroad, these days mostly Romania and Bulgaria, while 63% of all staff employed by members of the British Meat Processors Association are not from the UK. Around 400,000 people work in food manufacturing, and more than 30% of those are from somewhere else. And if free movement of labour stops, the British food industry won't just face difficulties, some parts will shudder to a halt. Shelves will be emptied, prices will shoot up, and right now, none of those charged with negotiating Britain's exit from the EU are making promises that this scenario will be averted. Many of them aren't even engaging with the issue. The soft fruit business is right at the sharp end. From February to November, we need 29,000 seasonal workers across the sector, says Lawrence Ollins, chair of British Summer Fruits, the crop association for berries, which accounts for one in every £5 spent on fruit in the UK. And 95% of those are non-EU citizens. The industry has tried to get UK nationals to do the work, but they are simply not interested. Our hope is for some sort of permit scheme, Ollin says. But if, say, we only get half the permits we need, we will simply have only half the size of the industry. The 29,000 non-UK workers they have are therefore vital, and what's more, the number required is growing. Rain is quite passionate about this stuff, Warren. It's an area that just needs to be tackled, isn't it?
I think it's another one that, it absolutely needs to be on the menu. It should be served up. It should definitely be on the table.
Very good, very good, very
people
good.
People have an appetite for this, Tim. They are hungry for it.
You can overpun. I'm just saying that.
You're absolutely right. To come back to normality, this one affects everybody. There are so many knock-on issues that are going to affect everybody. But the food that we eat is taken for granted in so many ways. Whether that's its impact on the environment, where it's come from, whether that's actually labelling versus what's in it, as in the world of sports nutrition, or whether that's in terms of, frankly, who's cooking your food in the restaurants, who's bringing it to your table. who is picking it in the fields, every single element of that, there is a huge influx of non-UK residents, certainly non-UK passport holders, working there. And I would expect Jay Rayner's figures that he has there can only be the tip of the iceberg. Those figures are only going to get bigger the more areas of the any area of the food industry you're going to look into. So
he may not be entirely unbiased, I'm guessing. I imagine he probably owns, you reckon he owns a few restaurants and food outlets, a few fast food gaffes around the place.
I think, as you know as well as I do, Tim, that, you know, as a respected journalist, then Jay Rayner couldn't possibly have a single conflict of interest anywhere. His morals must be absolutely squeaky clean. Even if he did take a swing at a French restaurant, notably recently, and seemingly quite rightfully, but that didn't go down very well for many people. But to get back on track with it, his point is made very well. He has a great position to make that point. Clearly, he would like there to still be restaurants so he can keep going and talking about them. That is his bread and butter.
Bread and butter.
You see, I just can't help it, you know. But the point that if that labour force is not there, or if even only half of it's there, only one thing that can happen, you know. Well, either there's not going to be the stuff, we have to have more imports, which costs more money and has other knock-on effects, or the producers, the processors and the restaurants, everybody have to increase wages for staff in order to attract other staff more domestically, which is only going to result in a big knock-on to the consumer. And it's, you know, I think in putting the issue out there is worthwhile.
Is this not a similar case to guaranteeing the rights of EU citizens in this country, where we simply should just take the moral high ground and say, where permits are needed, sort out certain sectors of the society, in terms of the food industry in this case, we just guarantee workers' rights, and then it's done?
That, Tim, is a breath of fresh air and common sense, which unfortunately may not come to pass, only because there are going to be so many different groups, all of them significant, who are going to be asking for this sort of thing, and they're all going to have to be on a list of priorities, because the scale of what has to be unpicked and rebuilt is that significant. In the meantime, that can only cause volatility, which certainly will cause gains for some, but it's going to cause loss and hardship for others. So anyone who has a platform to bring these issues to light now to try and bump them up the head of the queue, go for it. And I think this is a very valuable one. Would you agree?
I would. Do you know what? I'd like to get some official lines on this. And if anybody knows, if anyone wants to get in touch about this and find out what officially the planning is currently and how this whole thing is moving forward, then I'd be interested to have them on the show. It obviously ties into immigration, migrants, but it also does tie into the food that we're going to have on our tables as well. It's pretty much an important one, I think.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and it's one of those effects that nobody would have ever thought of initially, but now you lay it out in the plain light of day like that, it is so obvious, and so much it will impact absolutely everybody, because everyone's going to the supermarket.
Right, and finally, Warren, don't jump off your chair, but I'm going to introduce a new section, and it's going to, I'm going to call it, and we could maybe change this, but I'm going to call it Brextwit.
I think that's
Twitter
beautiful.
On Brextwit.
Brextwit.
It needs work. Yeah. So what I've done is I've braved the world of Twitter to reveal some insights from the best of our opinionated guests. It's not as if we haven't given them enough love by getting them on the show originally. Now we're going to pile back in to see what they've been saying on Twitter. So I've got a few. I've got four to start off with. And the first one is our great friend of the show. She's done our news review. She came on to talk about her new political magazine that she's launching. I think it's good timing because they called the general election, and her whole raison d'etre is this magazine to try and engage young people in the political system. At Steph Farnsworth on Twitter. Steph is STEPH. I'm not going to spell out everyone's Twitter handle. And she has a proudly pinned tweet at the top of her, what do you call it, Twitter feed? Yep.
Timeline, I suppose, or feed.
Timeline, that's the one, timeline. So it's proudly pinned there, crowdfunding campaign for new youth political magazine Stand Up. Good timing with the general election, I think. And there's a link for that if anyone wants to, if anyone wants to jump on, get youth more engaged. And Steph is crowdfunding for her new magazine, so we'll give her some props for that. Next up, we've got Ian Dunt, still our most popular show to date. And Ian is always the man with a finger on the pulse. And he's talking about how David Cameron never bothered to pretend he tried to hit the immigration targets. The problem is that Theresa May might actually do so. So Ian's very pro-Remain. And his, he links his tweet to a piece that he wrote where he says the Office of Budget Responsibility estimates that reducing net migration to 185,000 a year, it's currently 273,000, would force the government to borrow another £6 billion, almost three times the negative economic effect of higher inflation or falls in productivity growth. Reducing it all the way to the tens of thousands would cost somewhere in the tens of billions. So he said, well, Cameron always paid lip service to reducing this. He never had any intention of doing so. When George Osborne was the Chancellor, he basically admitted that after in his sort of post-Chancellor era. And this whole thing about saying is just a political hot potato, basically. The next, let's restore the balance a little bit to the Leave campaign. We've got one from David Curtin, who is a UKIP spokesman who came on to speak to us a good few months ago now. And he's tweeting that Brexit has been so good that only 22% still support Remain. And it's broken down in the following way. 45% are hard leavers, 23% are re-leavers. So they are effectively people that maybe initially voted Remain. And they now say that, do you know what, will of the people, let's just get on with it. And there's only 22% are still hard Remainers. And there's 9% who simply do not know. It does come from the Order website, Warren, which is a Guido Fawkes, who's pretty leavy, I think, pretty Tory website-y. So, you know, how much can we trust polls?
Well, we all know that there are lies, damn lies, and statistics, and polls historically get it wrong, but they exist for a reason, and you need that stuff out there. Those figures, I'm going to guess, have not simply been thrown up via a dartboard. And some analysis has been done, even if only it was, 12 people on a bus in Crewe, who knows? But figures they are, and interesting to hear.
Yeah, and if the general election does result in a landslide to the Tories, then you can argue that perhaps they've been justified, given how much Brexit and the issues over Brexit is dominating the landscape.
Absolutely.
And our final one from the lovely Lembit Opik. Very much enjoyed having Lembit as a guest. And he says, what are party leaders' views on freedom of movement for seasonal workers? Example, Santa Claus. I mean, will post-Brexit Britain have to cancel Christmas?
That's all for today, folks. The show's been brought to you by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Pohl, and the theme music by Kevin MacLeod. For all things Brexit podcasts, go to brexitpodcast.com, and we look forward to welcoming you to a future episode.